with William Isom II. He is the director of Black in Appalachia. He's a sixth generation East Tennessean and coordinates Black in Appalachia's research, community database development, documentary film and photography production, the oral history collection, and educational events with residents. So welcome to the Talkin' Appalachian podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amy.
So I just want to start by asking you to talk a little bit more about what Black in Appalachia is, the organization, and the kind of work you do there.
Yeah, we started doing this work. This is the 11th year, which seems crazy to me. And started out as a project with East Tennessee PBS, public television in Knoxville. And then about 3 years ago, we rolled out into a freestanding organization. So now we're Black in Appalachia Research, Education, and Support is the long name, is the government name. We do that, conduct research with residents in support of them telling their own narratives, produce short documentary films. We do census data collection, and we also have a bookstore and a research room here in rural East Tennessee, in Whitesburg, Tennessee. And so we do a lot of everything to try to help grab these scraps of Black history across the Appalachian region to help communities tell their own stories. And that can look very different in a lot of different ways. It could be helping the church down the road write a grant so that they can get their windows fixed. It can be digitizing community members' personal items in Bluefield, West Virginia, or it can be producing short films around racial atrocities in the region. So it can look like all kinds of different things because the need is so vast.
Story preservation is everything. I mean, it is everything. It matters. I was listening to the Black in Appalachia podcast yesterday, and I want to encourage my listeners to go over there and listen because there was a delightful interview with a 102-year-old woman from Knoxville. Mm-hmm. I think her name was Clara. Is that right?
Clara. Yeah.
It was so wonderful. She was so wonderful.
Yeah, Clara Hughes is actually from a coal town. She's from Oliver Springs, Tennessee, which is a Tennessee coal camp, coal town. But the podcast by far is the most popular thing. You know, only so many people care about census data, you know, produced by two really brilliant women, Dr. Nkeshi Alamine and Angela Dennis. They take a lot of the historical stuff that we find in oral history stuff and kind of look at it in a contemporary light.
Yeah, I've been listening to some interviews of survivors. I don't know if you've heard of the Rykov cyclone that happened in 1929. I found these interviews. They're at ETSU in the Appalachian Archives. And this wonderful woman, Frances Reed, recorded interviews with the survivors in 1970. And she recorded members of the Carter family talking about AP's involvement in going over there and picking up the bodies and helping with the children. And to hear that, you know, that's 53 years ago, to hear them talking about that event, it just reaffirms for me why I do the work that I do and the importance of that work, because it's lost otherwise. It's lost.
I heard somebody say one time, even when we pass away, the only thing that we leave are stories.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that's left.
It's our legacy. Absolutely. You and I met, I think it was 2013 when I started doing this research. It's hard to believe it's been that long ago.
Yeah.
I know. A decade. A little over a decade.
Holy moly.
Time flies, man.
Yeah, so, that's a decade.
I know. Just sort of go back in time just a little bit and talk and tell our listeners how we met. So I think that's the first time we met, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. My whole life, I heard about this burial ground from the older folks in my family, and they called it the slave cemetery, and it was on family property. And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this. I never thought about asking more questions because I was a kid, and you don't realize these things until you're older. And it's sad because the people who know the most about it are gone now. Around 2013, a little bit before 2013, I returned to that space in my mind and started writing about it. And I just developed this desire to want to know more about it. Why is it there? Why is it on my family's property? Lee County, Virginia is the space that we're talking about. That's where I'm from. I forgot to say that. So Lee County, for those who don't know, is the westernmost tip of Virginia. So it's right in the heart of Central Appalachia. It borders Kentucky and Tennessee and North Carolina. And so you wouldn't know this burial ground was there if you were just walking through the woods, because the stones were covered with ivy, the trees had fallen on them, they were covered in leaves. So the first place I thought I would go to find out more, and let me say this, because we're going to get into this too. We were talking about the preservation of story, but the preservation of marginalized voices, I think, is especially important. People who were not given a voice. And I think that's where I'm coming from on this as well. So mostly white community. And so that was the narrative that I grew up with. It was a white narrative of Appalachia. So when I started to think about this burial ground and what the family had told me about, I thought, well, that doesn't align with everything I learned in school, right? We were taught in our history classes that Appalachian people, there was no slavery. There was this story of, no, it was elsewhere. We have this rocky, hilly farmland. No one could afford to own slaves, you know, those kinds of things. So it's all these questions. So I go upstairs to the history department, my colleague, Brian McKnight, who's also a Lee Countyan, and he put me in touch with you and several other people. And that's how we met. You came to the burial ground, you met me there, and we walked through. And that's where the research began. So what did you think the first time you saw that space?
I was really excited because there were other conversations around other Black cemeteries in Southwest Virginia at the time. And that was the one I was most interested in just hearing about it. And so when Willie Dodson reached out to me and introduced us to each other, that was most interesting, particularly because of the lack of narrative around enslaved people in Lee County. Yeah, first seeing that space, my first impression was the trek to get there, right? Like we're trekking in kind of this line following you up the hill to the space. And so its position on the hill was the first thing I noticed and my first impression. And then you don't immediately see the evidence of the cemetery until you kind of stop and look, and then it's like, oh, okay, there's a tombstone. Yeah, the kind of silence of the place. Nothing was, there wasn't any text on the stones, and so there wasn't anything to talk to you in that space except for, you know, kind of the silence of the position of the cemetery.
Yeah, it is very silent, very peaceful. Mm-hmm. The stones were covered in what my granny called graveyard ivy. And yeah. I learned later that's vinca, and that's a common vine that you find in burial grounds. But yeah, they're like old teeth. They're different sizes. They're leaning. Some have fallen. Some have been placed back up against trees. So we really didn't know what to make of it. There, you know, at first we thought there was some organization to the stones, and then we started to realize maybe that wasn't the case because so many trees had fallen. Right of way had been cut. This is on a hill, but near the road. Mm-hmm. So the story I had been told, my great, great grandmother told mm-hmm. my grandmother, she was the first to say that that's what it was. So the fact that I had a living descendant that remembered another living descendant who was actually in touch with the owners of the land, mm-hmm. Because I was born to very young parents. So I had great-great-grandparents for a while. And that's what made this more believable for me but she said there was a cornfield right up to the edge of the cemetery at the time. And they knew to hoe up, you know, they knew that that's where they stopped. And you didn't go into the burial ground because that's where that was. That led to the GPR research, the ground penetrating radar, because we knew that we could read to some extent the position of the stones, but we really had to know where the bodies were. If there were bodies, we wanted to make sure that it was in fact a burial ground, because these are field stones. There's a pattern of roundness and the peaks, but it's almost like, am I really looking at that? You know, is it what I think it is? Because this is still very rocky terrain. I got a little grant and invited Rhett Herman, who was a physicist from Radford, to bring his GPR, ground penetrating radar equipment. And for those who don't know what ground penetrating radar does, it emits a pulse into the ground, and that bounces off of whatever matter is down there, and it comes back up in a computer program, and it looks like an EKG. It looks like waves. And someone who's trained to read that knows what they're looking at. And this is a common thing, particularly with burial grounds where the stones have been moved or there are no stones and you want to map the ground and see what's under there. So you came that day for a little while. You were able to come document some of that. It looked like a lawnmower and he moved it. You mapped the ground. We cleared it. My husband and I cleared it and he mapped the ground with flags. And then he moved the machine back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then we saw what was in the ground. And I think that for me was a moment when I saw that for the first time. Had you ever done anything like that?
I'd never been around a ground penetrating radar, so I was not going to miss that. And, you know, whenever you said that that was happening, I think I had other stuff to do that day, but I made sure to be there for some of that because I really wanted to see that process. And it was good to see how meticulous Dr. Herman had to be in order to keep track of the results with the setting of the grid. And, you know, you and your husband like really worked with him to set those flags and set the grid. And then the process by which he takes that, what looks like a lawnmower, over the stumps and the roots and whatever else is in there to try to map that, and how meticulous it was really was interesting for me to see. And then to see the results, and also how cautious Dr. Herman was in the analyzing of the results. Mm-hmm. It was interesting for me to see he was very meticulous in the gathering of the data, and then also very meticulous in his interpretation of the data as well, to say these things correlate to be what could be a burial ground. And so it's like that's, mm-hmm. I think that is a very impressive way of handling data.
Yeah. And he had done that several times before, and even on plantation lands. It's different terrain when you're in the woods, and that worried him that we wouldn't get the kind of images that we needed. But it confirmed A, that it was burial ground. B, he was able to date it possibly to about early 1800s. I think that's what he said. And it aligned with his other experiences mapping the burial grounds of enslaved people. The characteristics seemed to align. So we were trying to create the probability of the oral history matching up.
To hear a bonus episode, including the full story and images, subscribe on our Patreon page. The essay titled The Rocks was mentioned in 2016's Best American Essays, edited by Jonathan Franzen, and won the Lamar York Prize for Nonfiction. You can also subscribe to YouTube for images of the burial ground, the woven coverlet, and the GPR images of the remains. You'll find all the links in the show notes of how to join our communities and to support the podcast. Thanks, and remember to keep talking Appalachian.
And then when we saw, you know, they show up like these red cocoons, and the technology, that was 10 years ago, so who knows what they look like now, but they show up as these red cocoons, and they were lined up, could read the size, the length, told us about the age of the deceased, how they were buried in clusters. He suggested that was family members buried together in a space. And so this little puzzle started to come together just a little bit, but then we had to go into records, and that was difficult. We hit something called the wall. Do you want to talk about that? Pre-1870 wall.
Yeah. You know, and that's one of the reasons we do the work that we do around census data. We take the free people of color, 1860, the slave schedule from 1860, and the entire population of color, 1870, for entire counties, basically create a black census from those records to make it easier for families to be able to research from when people are listed as full families with names, full human beings, to back into when you're nameless pieces of property. And so that's what we were trying to do, not without any kind of way forward. I mean, you had a couple of names in regards to slaveholders in the area, but we were trying to then, through finding the landed slaveholding white males, we were trying to find any mention of enslaved people that may have passed away in that area. You know, just to kind of give some context, Lee County in 1860, just before the Civil War, had, you know, there was 133 slaveholders in Lee County and just 23 free people of color in 1860. So before national emancipation. And so that was 729 enslaved people in Lee County in 1860. And so who out of those 729 and decades before that, how do we sift through these nameless pieces of property to try to find mention of burial when they weren't even considered as full human beings? And so, yeah, so we went several times to Lee County Courthouse in Jonesville and looked through literally everything to try to find any mention of death records.
So my part of it, if you'll remember, I started with a death portrait, a little girl's death portrait that hung on my great grandmother's wall, because a family member told me that the landowner that he remembered was in that portrait. And that was my third or fourth great grandmother standing in that portrait. And that's what I learned. You know, it was just amazing to me to find out some of the things I found out. But I tried to trace the landownership back as far as I could and then match tax records, more oral histories. Another section of my family that does this wonderful, they have so much research that they've done. They were really the ones that helped me out because they had another piece of oral history that we added to these materials. The woman who owned the property, her husband was a Confederate veteran, and her father was a wealthy landowner that supposedly had enslaved people on his property. And the family story was that she was given as a wedding gift, several enslaved people. And the members of the family that I talked to had a piece of a coverlet that they said was woven by a couple of these women. And they had given pieces to the family, but it was in a frame with pictures of the landowners and the oral history typed out, which was amazing to me. I sent that off to Berea, or I sent pictures to Berea, to a textile expert, and had that person examine as best he could. And he determined that it could have come from that time period. He determined that the colors came from plant dyes. It was all amazing to me. I learned so much from this, but he dated it to that time period. So things were lining up as far as that goes, but we still could not find. I went to Richmond, Virginia, to look at tax record and could not find any mention of, you know, they had to pay taxes on human property, and I'm using air quotes, just like everything else. Mm-hmm. But they had not recorded those. And so I interviewed another gentleman that said sometimes that didn't happen because they didn't want to pay taxes. So, you know, sometimes you could get away with that.
Yeah. And there was no, you had the oral history. It was similar to the gravesite itself. You had the oral history about the gravesite. And then we had additional data that corroborated that oral history. And there was also this oral history. You had, you knew who the land belonged to during that time period, but there was no evidence of enslaved holding of slaves from that landowner. And so that's where we were like, what? So we were like in the basement trying to find anything. And you went to Richmond. Can you hide? I guess people could hide enslaved slave holding from government bureaucrats so you don't have to pay taxes. You know, is that what was happening?
But then remember, we found a picture of this man, the wealthy landowner, the father of the woman who had the property. And in 1870, his census revealed free people of color living on his homestead.
Yeah.
And they're in that picture. So why? What was that all about? Mm-hmm. You know? With the same last name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So denotes ownership in some way, or previous ownership, at least.
In the process of doing this research, you uncovered some things about your own family, didn't you?
I did, because one of the things that I like to say is you generally want a slaveholder to die, but you want a slaveholder to die before the end of the Civil War so that they may inventory their estate. And that inventory sometimes can include the names of enslaved people in their estate. And so while we were looking over, you know, hell and high water, everything that we could find to try to find some information about who may be buried there. And I was looking through wills and estates for what was just called the Western District of Virginia, which was Lee County, I think probably would be Wise County and Scott County, Virginia. They were all kind of lumped together. And I was just like going through every will and just looking for names. It wasn't indexed. And just so happened to find my great-great-grandfather, Kelson Isom, and his enslavement in Gate City, Virginia. And so, you know, for 20 years, we knew that he was born in slavery. We knew that he was from Virginia, but we didn't know where in Virginia. And lo and behold, there he was listed in the inventory of his slaveholder that died, and his value, he's valued at $1,200. And his mother was listed in there. I think she was valued at like $100, which sounds, I mean, value on any human is terrible, but that is salt in the wound. But yeah, so through our searching all records for enslaved people in the region, I actually found my great-great-grandfather listed in those wills. And so I was able to break through that wall in doing our research. So it also goes to show how thoroughly we looked through all the records, because in that thoroughness, I actually happened to find something that was about my own family.
How did that feel to find that?
You know, it wasn't the first time I had found an ancestor in, enslaved ancestor in the records. But not the first time, I think the feelings were a little bit, it was disbelief. And you just kind of stare at the name for a while, and then you show it to other people to be like, what does this say? And then to make sure you're not crazy or hallucinating. And so you like show it to a couple of people, like, okay, I'm not crazy. And then you just kind of sit and look at it for a little while and let it process, because it's like, well, okay, well, there you are. There you've been. You know, the first time that happened to me, that I found an enslaved ancestor in the records, I got really mad. I got really angry. And then I got really, it was like this progression of emotion. Then I got really sad. But then almost immediately, you know, this is all within a span of 10 minutes, I got really excited, then really mad, and I wanted to burn down whatever building I was in. And then I got sad. But then something settled in that was more of a determination. And it's like, oh, well, no, they survived. And because they survived through this enslavement, since they survived through this African Holocaust in North America, I'm here. And so it's like, okay, what I'm going through is nothing compared to what they went through, so I can be here. And so I almost feel like it's like, okay, I can be your revenge.
Well, it is. It's really complicated. I mean, and I was so glad to have you as a co-researcher, because over here I was having my experience, mm-hmm. and to be able to talk with you about your experience, I mean, it just sort of braided together perspectives, points of view, backgrounds, race, all of it. And if nothing else happens with this, that was worth it to me, that you found your family, that I uncovered things I didn't know. Because in the process of over the 10 years of doing this, I've raised two kids from, you know, being little bitty to being teenagers, and they've watched this happen and they've learned from it. And so that's really meaningful to me. We got so far. It's almost like we could touch it, but not quite. You went and did some work, and I went and did some work, and we've kind of sort of let it sit for a while. What would you like to see happen with this going forward?
Yeah, it's interesting, because, you know, and somebody had mentioned this to me one time, that perhaps this is, they were talking about Americans and storytelling, and how we always have to have there has to be a resolution to it. And in doing this work, sometimes there's no, you don't get a resolution, the story just stops, right? And so I try sometimes to accept that, even though, you know, you're like, maybe there's something, but maybe it is what it is. And it's also a narrative that's a testament to the loss of this history. And I think that it's not necessarily a bad thing for us to, that we tried and say, like, there may not be a resolution to the story. And this is illustrative of enslaved narratives in North America. You know, I think, you know, like a little marker on the ground says what we know would be, you know, like a, you know, tombstone marker that designates it. You've registered it with the state and keep it cleaned up and maintained. For me, that's maybe enough.
I went back with my cousin, who is also a descendant of the people who own the property, and the woods takes it back. It takes it back immediately because it is right in the heart of the woods. And I felt guilty because the woods had taken it back so fiercely that we almost couldn't find the stones. Oh, wow. Again. The ivy, the leaves, the trees had grown back, Will. But it's been 10 years. That's what I can't believe, is that the time has passed. But in 10 years, all the trees have grown back. These seedlings dropped and grew. I think the fact that it's registered, that we recognized, you know, we uncovered a lot of material in the process of this. And Lee County, for me, you know, again, we're rewriting that history that we thought we knew and including the voices that need to be included. And I think about Ron and the late Jill Carson and the Appalachian African American Cultural Center there in Pennington, just a few miles away, and how maybe this in some ways contributes to the collection that they've worked so hard.
It helps feel a hole in the narrative. Like, we know from arrival, and this is just me thinking out loud, like, you know, we know from arrival when Daniel Boone and all those people, they came through Lee County. You know, the Wilderness Road came through Lee County. And as soon as these pioneers and explorers and colonizers came through, and land speculators, enslaved people were with them. You know, 20% of the people that traveled the Wilderness Road were enslaved. So that's, you know, 20 to 60,000 enslaved people traveling through Lee County at the point of colonization. And then enslavement settles in as a vital component of the economy of Lee County that makes Lee County function. And then there's the U.S. Civil War, and Lee County was a Confederate hub. It was a hotspot for the Confederacy, so much so that there was people ferrying men from East Tennessee to Kentucky to join the Union. Lee County was like, okay, we got to make it through Lee County to get to Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And so it was not a hospitable place for Union sympathizers or Black people. And then after the Civil War, you had sent me that report by T.E. Rose that talked about the Klan-like activity after the Civil War that basically did ethnic expulsions of Lee County to expel the Black populations. And, you know, Preston Mitchell has worked on that story of the freedmen that left Lee County and established flourishing Black colony we were up there for that cemetery. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the story of this is one of the only physical things that people can see and put their hands on that tell that narrative within that gap. So we've got this story of Black arrival at colonization. We've got the records about enslavement, and we've got some information about slave life in Lee County. But this is a physical, people could touch it and see it. And I think that this cemetery is an important component in telling that narrative. I'm just really glad that we dug into this 10 years ago. I can't believe that time goes by so quickly. I'm really glad that we did what we could do for this. And right now I'm working on a short film about Black life in Southeastern Ohio around Emancipation Celebration and the oldest continually celebrated Emancipation Day in North America, September 22nd. Hmm. They celebrate the day that Abraham Lincoln signed the first draft of the Emancipation Proclamation. So they didn't even wait. They were like, he put ink on paper. We're celebrating that day.
Well, thank you so much. It's so good to see your face again and to talk to you again and revisit this story. And who knows, it may not be over.
It may not. New stuff pops up all the time.
Down below, I don't know if you remember, but you know, across the road. So there's the burial ground in the woods, and then there's a road. Across the road is the home place. The uh-huh. old home place where the landowners lived. So the remains, there used to be a house there, but there's still a barn there. There's a barn and a pond. And I don't know if you remember that.
I do. Yeah. It's picturesque, like looking
yes,
over there.
Yes, it's beautiful. Yeah, yeah. My cousin Angela came to visit, and we were stomping around. And we had been there many times before. We, you know, we look around and we tell stories and we talk about what we found in that barn. but we had never like stuck our hands into holes and things like that. And a few months ago, we went back. We took a couple of new family members back down there, and we were talking to them about it. That's when I discovered the woods had just swallowed it up again. But she started sticking her hands in holes. And it makes me nervous because I know rats, there's hay in there. And, you know, this is an old, over 100 years old barn. But she pulls out a Bible, Will.
Wow.
That had been in there for almost 100 years. And the man's name was written inside, the dates. Her family are the ones that do all the collecting and the family history and stuff. So he was in the Spanish-American War. And we know how he was connected to the people who lived there, my great-great-great-grandmother. And he had written in that Bible, and she found a whiskey bottle beside it. So I guess he went down there and read his Bible and drank his whiskey. But
he had the two important things in life.
Yes. Just the fact that survived in a barn that's falling down. I mean, a tree's holding it up right now. But I mean, it was a little bit rat gnawed, but it had survived. I mean, you could read the inscriptions on the inside. So she found a photo of him. We had this three-dimensional person, you know, from this Bible. And so that's what gives me hope that there's a Bible somewhere or a journal somewhere or a letter somewhere that could be the missing link that could give us the names of these folks and tell us who they are. Appreciate you. Appreciate all your work, the work you did with me on this. You worked really hard and kept going. I think after I had almost given up on it, you kept going. And I'm just really proud of what we found.
Yeah, me too. I think I feel good about it.
I'd like to give a special shout out to Barbara Parker. Barbara, we thank you for all of your support.